Good afternoon, everybody. Could I just ask those of you who are still yet to be seated to take a seat so we can get today underway? My name is Megan Lloyd. I'm the editor of the Sunday Mail and I'm also the president of the SA Press Club. Welcome to all of you today, and also to welcome our guest speaker, Peter Lloyd, no relation. I don't know if Peter's come across many people with the surname Lloyd in journalism in Australia. I certainly have, particularly in Adelaide. There was a time there when there was about four of us with the surname Lloyd working in Adelaide, most of it in newspapers, and none of us were related. Very common. But then, you know, when you have a surname that is the Smith and Brown in Wales, the equivalent of, there's going to be bound to be a few of you around. Welcome to today's Press Club lunch. I would just like to acknowledge some important people that we have here today, one of them being Jeff Timms from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, who, of course, is always very generous to Press Club, to the Press Club and lunch today. We also have Dan Van Hulst-Pelican, who is the member for Stuart, one of our regional MPs, who's also here today. Welcome. I'd also like to welcome all the working members of Adelaide's media who are also here today. And I'd like to acknowledge Telstra, who are another great sponsor of our SA Press Club. Today, we'll enjoy wines from Jacobs Creek and beers from SA Brewing. I'll be back just around main course time to introduce our guest speaker. And I'd also just like to remind you that we have a raffle again today. Looks like we have the voucher from Jeff Timms Manufacturing, which is a $300 voucher, carton of beer from SA Brewing, which looks like James Squire Nine Tails Amber Ale, and two lots of red and white from Jacobs Creek. So tickets are, as usual, three for $5, so, you know, got to be in it to win it. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Sorry, on to the second part and the main event of our lunch today. Our guest speaker today is Peter Lloyd, who is a journalist and a reporter with the ABC's Nightly News and current affairs program, Late Line. Peter was previously ABC's Southeast Asia correspondent, originally in New Delhi, first of all, when he reported for Australian National, for the ABC, sorry, across national and international radio, TV, news, current affairs, all their programming. He actually started as a journalist in 1985 and started reporting for Australian audiences from the UK, Europe, Africa and the United States. Some of this, I actually have to say, is I've lifted from his biography on the ABC website, which I can credit that Peter actually wrote himself, which I've since discovered. He joined the ABC in 1988 in Sydney and before moving to Britain to work for BBC and British Sky News. Came back to Australia and actually went to work in commercial television and current affairs as a reporter, presenter, executive producer, and also spent some time in North America as another correspondent there. In 2000, he took up a senior role with the ABC, working on programs as AM, The World Today, PM, all shows I'm sure you're familiar with, and, of course, television news. In mid-2002, he was appointed to the Southeast Asia Bureau for the ABC. If you're based in Delhi, and then eventually it was Bangkok, reporting on things like Southeast Asia affairs in Thailand, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Singapore, and the Philippines. Of course, in that period of time, we had the Bali bombings and later the tsunami disaster, of which his coverage was extensive. Peter was due to come back to Australia in October 2008 to co-host Breakfast News for the ABC, which they were launching, when he was arrested in Singapore on drug charges. It was July 18, 2008. you know, and he was one of a number, I guess, of period of time of Australians who were arrested overseas and eventually jailed for drug possession. He was arrested in Singapore and charged with drug-related offences. Police alleged that he was found with the possession of a small quantity of the drug ice, an improvised smoking pipe and six syringes. Singapore police said this urine tested positive for amphetamines and he was being investigated for trafficking a controlled drug. He was released on bail and spent a time for the next 4.5 months, obviously going through actual court before sentencing actually happened. There was, a semi-reprieve in the sense that Singapore's Attorney General dropped the harsher trafficking charge, leaving him to face 4 lesser charges. In December 2008, he was sentenced to 10 months in jail after pleading guilty to 3 of those charges and eventually was released after 200 days for good conduct. I just asked him earlier about, 200 days doesn't seem a long time, but I can imagine if you had been locked up, you would certainly have a different view of it. And since that time, he's returned to Australia. He's obviously recounted, and has talked about his experiences. He has written those down in a book called Inside Story, which were published in October 2010. And I was interested in one of those aspects of that, which he's apparently talked about conversations with ants while he was in jail. This whole process, I guess, has also led him to talk about the fact that he's sort of come out as being gay, and also looking, I guess, at how Australia handles the drug debate, both here and abroad. This was an occasion when the journalist did become the story. So to talk about his experiences, Peter Lloyd.
You know, when I hear these sort of comments, I wonder why this guy doesn't like the quiet life. can I just start by thanking Jackie Drew and Grant Heading, who's not here today. He's got the unfortunate task of being busy at Channel 10 with delivering bad news, I understand. There was a time back in 2008 when I wondered if I was living the first line of my obituary. A fall from grace, as you've just heard described here by my namesake, is just that. And I don't think there's too many people here in this room who'd argue that my fall was pretty epic. And can I tell you that there comes a point in the experience of public disgrace when one feels overwhelmed not only by the fall, but by the seemingly insurmountable notion of any kind of climbing back up. To some, probably in this room, it may seem surprising or even astonishing that I've come this far. And I can tell you that it wasn't always clear to me that I could or would do that. Today, if you'll indulge me for a few minutes, I'll share some insights that led us to being here. The key factors for me in overcoming this personal crisis in Singapore, there are two of them. One is circumstance and the other is choice. That is to say, how the events unfolded and how I responded to them. And before I start sounding clinical or even contrived, let me tell you that it wasn't always thus that I was this assured or certain about what it was that was going on. At the time of my arrest in Singapore, I was in the midst of a breakdown, and I wasn't in any sense rational. And for a few weeks there, I was captured by the events and swept along. Any rhyme or reason that you may have seen or perceived in my public demeanour then was due to the support of my family and my friends. They rallied around me and they were making decisions that I wasn't ready or able to make. I did not choose to go to a trauma counsellor. I was taken there. I did not find a lawyer. They were found for me. And the sure-footedness that I found eventually in Singapore, that came only after the initial shock and the trauma of that arrest was dealt with and the diagnosis came. And I have to say that the stabilisation, the getting it together, came with the help of medication, not the self-medicated kind that got me into such a world of trouble. But the stressed person's friend, the antidepressants and the sleeping pills, and not enough can be said about the shameless embrace that we should all take at the time that that happens to us in our lives. There's nothing wrong with medication of the right kind. For me, it was medication and psychiatric treatment that stabilised the condition of post-traumatic stress and put me in the right sort of shape to regain the calm in a crisis demeanour that got me into so much trouble in the first place at the ABC. They kept sending me to places because I could cope. Now, the turning point in Singapore, what it was that helped me begin the climb back up, actually began in the past. And it was a meeting with the Dalai Lama. In April 2008, I came across him for the second time in my life. And we were in northern India covering the story of the monk uprising in Tibet. The Dalai Lama lives in Dharamshala, which is this mountainous Tibet-like estate of northern India where he's been allowed to live since exile. And Holiness called us into a room. He loves being called Holiness. Called us into a room about the size of this room. And held forth for about 2.5 hours, a short speech by his standards, and went on and on about the world and the crisis and putting his perspective. And at the end of it, he came around to the tables of the journalists and shook everyone's hand and thanked us for coming along. And he was shaking my hand. And I later got the time code on the camera and rolled it back and counted how long it was for. It was 100 seconds. And I can tell you that someone holding your hand for 100 seconds is a long time. And at the end of it, I leant in and I said, "Are we going steady?" And he looked at me. And you could tell no one had ever said that to him. Strangely enough. And he said, "No." And then did this uppercut. And probably the first in his life. Now, the point of the story is this, is that during his long oration, the Dalai Lama talked to us about anger and fear in the context of if everyone just let go of anger and fear in your life, what a different world we'd live in. And that didn't make any impact on me for some time, and it was months later in Singapore. His words came back to me with a resonance that I hadn't really considered. And, you know, I'd ask you to consider this now in this room. If you think about the one thing in your head that is a little problem or a dilemma, something that's weighing on your mind, in the mix of that, if you take out fear, if you take out anger, is that crisis still a crisis? Is it still there? Can you see a way of dealing with it in a different way than if you're not afraid or if you're not angry? Is the problem even a problem? So, you know, for me, that became sage retrospective advice, and it became a personal philosophy for me in Singapore that underpinned how I began dealing with what happened. And rather than pat myself on the back here, I'll quote from a review of my book, Inside Story, that sums up succinctly the most immediate effect or consequence of giving up on fear and anger as part of the equation in that crisis. The review says, "While Lloyd's self-reliance contributed to the condition that delivered him into a most distressing predicament, it served him well when the time came to prepare for incarceration." And when I look back, I think that's about right. I can see that I was fortunate to go into this crisis with one extra tool, and that was an essential resilience. It's part of who I am. And until Singapore, I hadn't really seen myself as a person of resilience. It's only something I think you identify and recognise in any of us and yourselves when a crisis comes along and you're put to the test. So what did I do in Singapore? What steps did I take to cope with this? And the answer is I did a list. I'm a list maker by heart. And the trick, I think, in a crisis, whether it's journalism or any other crisis in your life, is to not to think of the whole, but to think of it as a series of steps. So I broke it down. Instead of thinking about the catastrophe that had happened and started dealing with that, what I did was I put things in a list and ordered priorities. And I worked through it. And regardless of how unpleasant some of them were, and some of them were pretty unpleasant, they were addressed openly, as honestly as I could, and in order. And the first item was, I think, the item which drew the attention of the press club, and that's post-traumatic stress disorder. I spent hours between the arrest in July. I was released on bail about 5 or 7 days later. Spent hours between that July period and early December when I was locked up in the basement of an office of a counsellor, learning about post-traumatic stress disorder, learning about memory, what it is, how we receive memory, how we store it, how the brain functions, and how it can be dysfunctional. In journalism, and all of us in journalism are like this, I think, we need to learn and we need to understand in order to process information. We need to get it before you get it, and then we fashion it into a story. And in matters of mental health, I did and continue to do the same. I put myself through a crash course in the pernicious condition of post-traumatic stress disorder and the human brain. I call it pernicious because it is. It's a mongrel. It gets you and it gets a hold of you and you don't know it's there. And I think that the comparison I often make to people when I'm explaining it, because it does require some explaining, is it's a bit like cancer. You could have cancer and it can be doing things to you, but you don't know for a long time. You don't know until there's a diagnosis. And post-traumatic stress disorder is like, I guess, the cluster of mental illness on the spectrum of mental illness. The person who's got it, the victim, is the least likely to identify it in themselves. And that's the answer to a lot of the questions people probably had about it with me and with others, is that by the time you're in that situation, you're too far down the hole to know you're in a hole. And that's something you have to come to terms with. And that was... links you back to the question of the fear and anger, is you've got to let go of the anger you have to yourself for disappointing yourself. If you have high standards of others, you probably have them of yourself. And that is I think, where the Dalai Lama's sage advice came in most handy for me. So I put myself through this crash course in PTSD. I learned about the brain, and it was... the key to unlocking the fog of confusion that surrounded the condition. Item two on the list, and this is a big one, was dealing with the legal steps that followed it. Can I tell you that my lawyer told me from the get-go the outcome of this case, and he was right within about 6 or 8 weeks. Singapore is a city-state of mathematical certainty. It's mechanistic, it's invented by a lawyer, managed by engineers and technocrats, and nothing is left to the winds of chance, and that includes the criminal justice system. That is also why the jury system was abolished. They don't like risk. Singapore's legal system tends to exclude the accused from being wholly present for proceedings. In my case, there were a series of hearings, three I think, that while superficially appearing to take place in an open court, were in fact held behind a closed door behind the bench. If this were the courtroom, I'd be over there in the public gallery with everyone else, and they'd be out the back. I never saw the wheels of justice turn. At the end of each pre-trial conference, I was informed by my lawyer of each milestone and its outcome, but that was it. I can tell you that in Singapore, sentences are predetermined. They're set down by the higher court. They're handed down like tablets of stone from the magistrate, from the higher court to the magistrates for them to follow. So, item three, my personal preparation for the inevitable day when a hearing would end and I would go to jail. Being a pragmatic person, I had to decide what would make the inevitable endurable. It's been well documented, but let me give you a snapshot of what I did to prepare. number one on that list, and yes, there is a sub-list, I was set about to find some form of exercise that I could do in a controlled space. In Singapore, in prison, it's not like any of the movies. You don't have a gym. You don't have space to move around in. You don't have a telly. You can't smoke. You can't do anything. You're in a, and I just described with my arms. This is about the width of the cell, and it was about from there to the end of the stage. So it's a very small room. It is isolating. There's nothing in there. Knowing in advance that was what I was up for, and being a person who likes to move around a bit and likes my space, decided that Pilates was the way to go. And that was an essential part of the coping strategy for survival, having something to do to alleviate the tension, the physical tension and the sheer boredom and the physical stress of boredom that would come with being locked up. The second thing I did was I went book buying, and it was an orgy of book buying. And in the circumstances, I felt no guilt about spending a pile of money on buying books that I wanted to read. And after 6+ years of being on the road as a correspondent, where you don't really have a lot of time to do any reading apart from reading homework, you know, books about Southeast Asia or blah, 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 blah. I mean, you never get to read fiction and things that you want to read. I indulged, 6.5 years of frustration in that time and built up a really good personal library of stuff that I wanted to read in prison. And that for me was, that was a form of escape of the mental kind, which you need in that situation. And the conditions in Singapore and in the prison, they're a little odd. Literature is threatening to them for some reason. So they had a strict rule that you could only have 3 books brought in per month by your visitor. I only had one visitor who was allowed. So that was 3 per month. Then I figured out that you could have some sent in by mail, so I used that system. And the prison also had its own library, which was a hysterical collection of self-help and sort of Christian theology. It's a strange place. That was just the English section. So it was, 3 in, 3 out. And, the significance of that only, I think, came much later on, months later when I was in the prison. And I realised that I was given a notebook and I was allowed to keep a diary. But one of the prison officers took me aside one day and whispered in my ear, "They're not going to let you take that out." And it made it pretty clear that the me being who I was, writing a diary, was considered pretty incendiary by the authorities. And you need to make plans for how you're going to get this stuff out. So I did, and I started to. I'll show you by demonstration. I started to write in pencil for a book. This is the middle of the book, the spine. I used to write sort of sub-notes about my diary in here and here in pencil and in each page of the books that I was reading and then give them to Masley, my partner, who would take them out. He had no idea what I was doing, and being Singaporean, wasn't reading books anyway. So that was how the literature became quite critical about the story that I later told in the book Inside Story. It was... I think in hindsight, having revealed that I've done that, I think they've changed the regulations on how people get books in and out of Singapore. The physical limitations of the prison experience that I talked about before, the room being this wide, it does your head in. You heard earlier this anecdote about ants, and let me tell you about that one. I think it was a Saturday, and on weekends you're locked up for the whole weekend. You get time out of the cell from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays on the landing that you're on. Tuesdays and Thursdays, you go to the yard. And that is it. That's your yard experience for the week, 4 hours. The weekends is a total lock-up or lockdown. And I think that due largely to the global financial crisis had done something to their staffing, and so they had fewer guards. Fewer guards means more time in prison cell. So there I am one Saturday afternoon looking at the wall, and there's ants, a conga line of ants coming down and picking up the crumbs of a meal. And so I had an imaginary conversation with it, which ended up in the book, which is to tell you two things. One is that, yes, I'm a little bit nuts, and two, I was that bored. There was a little bit of television, but not a whole lot, and what you did see was heavily censored. The Singaporeans don't let inmates see free-to-air TV. They don't see the news. Newspapers, when they do receive them, are heavily censored. It's like a Get Smart episode where you pick up a newspaper and it's almost like holes in them, or they've painted them over. And the people whose job it is to paint them over are people whose English is a second language. So they have this aha kind of way of, yes, let's give the Burmese guy the English language newspaper and put a tick next to it and make him paint it black. Some of them, I don't know whether they were doing it on purpose or not. It was a form of revolt, but some of them didn't paint very well, so you could read through the black paint. So you could figure out what was going on. And then the other thing the Singaporeans hadn't figured out was that the news cycle being the way it is, today's front page story is tomorrow's page three follow, which they didn't black out. So in a matter of 24 or 48 hours, I knew what was in that paper's, you know, splash. And I took one of them aside and explained the sort of the basic concept of journalism to them, and they went, this is disturbing. They have absolutely no idea how we do our job. And their argument was, suspicious argument, but their argument's this, that we black out the newspapers because we think that we're protecting you from a crisis. And I said, what fucking crisis? If we're in prison. You know, the front page stories that they weren't blacking out were stories about the global financial crisis. The one thing that every prisoner I spoke to in that experience talked about was their personal concern that when they got out of prison, that they wouldn't be able to find a job because this crisis had made the economy so broken. And that was the story that they kept letting through. The stories they kept painting were things like plane crashes on Hudson River, everyone lives. They had no real concept of what it was that we, as inmates, were talking about. Before I wrap it up and open it up to questions, because I'm sure there's a few of them, I'd like to thank the Press Club for the opportunity of coming today, thank my namesake for the introduction, and thank Grant and Co for getting me over here. Every time I come to Adelaide, I think, why don't I live here? You've got the best wine, great beaches, the weather's not so good, but, you know, in Sydney today I was delayed in takeoff, and it was a bit disturbing because the reason we were delayed was the moment the captain pushed back, a voice came over the intercom and said, oxygen masks have been deployed. And it wasn't Tiger. Thanks very much for your attention. Thanks for the lunch.
Thank you, Peter. Obviously, it's customary now to open up the mic, which is right down the front today, to anyone. Obviously, it would be great if some working members of the media perhaps got in first. But if any of you do have a question for Peter, please come up. Maybe introduce yourself. We normally do that. I noticed some people didn't last time. So,
Peter, Ross Lamerson from The Advertiser. Thank you very much for a somewhat open discussion, which already has chairs being thrown. That's good. You've been quite open about the impact of post-traumatic stress, which is something that I've never approached. But any form of mental illness has an impact beyond the events that are so circumscribed. You've written about your time in jail. You've spoken about your time in jail. What are the things that happen today that still reflect upon those experiences? How has your life today changed?
Good question. It's like scar tissue, I think, or sediment at the bottom of a good glass of wine. It's always with you. A couple of months ago, at the end of summer, I was driving with a mate from the beach back home, and we came across a car accident and it was the first time I'd seen claret for a while. And the victim was a young woman, and it happened moments before we arrived. A young woman had run across an intersection being hit by a white minivan. And she was in quite a state, and we were the first people that pulled over. But the person that was with me has medical training and told me to pull over. I have to say I was tempted to keep going. And we did, and we rushed over, and he used beach towels to support her, and immediately identified when he was down on the ground that she had serious spinal injuries, and she was trying to get back up. And later I found out that had he not held her down and asked me to hold her with him, she would have killed herself. She was in a real state. And that moment of being there at that traffic accident was extremely challenging, because my instinct was to run away. Everything about me was saying, get the hell out of there. But this person needed my help. And so did the driver of the van that ran her over, because about 5 minutes after we sorted her out and the ambulance crews were coming, near riot began, because this family arrived from a few blocks away who were a notorious Sydney crime family. So I only vaguely realised who they were, but the person I was with was Indigenous and said, put the dots together for me, and I was like, oh, shit. And then the riot squad turned up, and I, before they arrived, I had to stand between the angry father of the victim and the elderly gentleman of the car who'd hit her, who was not at fault. She turned out to have been drunk and had run across the green light. He was in a hysterical state of near heart attack panic, and the father was throwing punches through and under me to try and get to this guy. And so I had to protect him from being torn apart by the mob. I'm thinking, this is not where I want to be. but I stuck it out. But I had I'll tell you how I felt, I started to rise above myself, literally. I could feel myself floating. This flotation feeling is something anyone who's had a stress disorder or a psychological illness on the spectrum probably recognise. You start to dissociate from where you are, and floating above it is something that I recognise very strongly, because the first time it happened was in Bali at the Bali bombing. I remember being in the ward where they were treating most of the critically sick people on day one, and holding the microphone, like literally holding the mic and talking to people, and gripping it so hard that I was digging the nails into my hand and drawing blood. And that was what was pulling me back down to the ground. So that kind of floating dissociation is something I'm very familiar with. But to cut a long, very long story short, it was actually a good event. All my reactions were normal for me. How I responded was correct. I stayed and helped the people who needed helping. I recognised what my body was doing and what my mind was telling me to do, and I didn't let that get in the way of what had to be done at the time, and it was okay. It's okay to be distressed by things like that. It's a perfectly normal reaction. And I'll give you another one. Is when the tsunami happened, it was a Friday afternoon, we were in the office at Late Line, and there's a bank of TV monitors up here, and everyone's watching the moment when the wave starts going through the paddocks. And I started to cry. And someone said, oh, are you all right to do this story? Because I was the one doing the lead on it. I said, yeah. I said, this is a normal reaction. You're the freaks. people, wow, look at that wave, man. It's like, that's people dying. You're watching people die. I'm more disturbed by their non-reaction than they were by my reaction. And I'm at peace with my reaction about that. That's okay. It's normal. And I think I'm probably more normal than I was before. I think not reacting that way is a little unusual. Yeah.
Aside from the post-traumatic stress, when that episode really crystallised a lot of changes in the mind.
Ah, okay, good question. They happened earlier. Yeah, no. That's an interesting question. People thought there was a connectivity between that and being gay. Now, being gay happened earlier, 2.5 years earlier. It's okay to be gay, don't worry. Penny Wong told me. She's gay, right? it's an interesting chronology, but my life was actually pretty happy and settled. Some years had passed between those two events. And, the post-traumatic stress is in of itself, it owns its own issues. And I think that, it was a fair error by the media, but it was just an error of you know, putting two and two together and getting five, which we all do sometimes when, you know, we're in a hurry for a deadline. But the PTSD, I think, was really, in a sense, something that I think I can almost say the day it began was Bali. I can almost tell you the time of day. It's something I can trace back.
Question. When somebody has an intense experience or something that's out of their normal or like yours was, it's we often latch onto those people as, you know, tell us your insights and you're the go-to person, to use a cliche, you become the poster boy for, you know, crime story or, you know, drugs, you know, overseas drugs, etc. I just wondered if, you know, how you've, when you've come back to Australia and now you are a member of the media, working media again, do you, how you view our coverage of, you know, the drugs issue, but also, you know, court stories and those sorts of things in general, has it given you a different perspective of it?
Yeah. I think that it's hard to know what's the difference. As you get older, and as you get older as a journalist, I think you become less certain. Certitude is for young people, I think. And whether that is something that would have happened anyway, or whether it's been intensified or has been driven by my experiences, I'm not entirely sure. For example, I was covering the Corby trial from the beginning and the Bali Nine. I have a personal compassion for all of them, but it is heightened by what happened to me. And each of them has their own reasons for what got them there. And it's not for me to judge them. It's never been for me to judge them. But I have enormous compassion for Schapelle Corby because it doesn't matter really what happened. What's happened to her as a consequence is awful. And the conditions in which she's been kept, don't ever think for a minute that she's in some sort of luxurious, easy-peasy kind of, you know, jail. It's not. It is a desperately awful third-world concrete block, hot, unpleasant place full of people who are in their own way, for each and every one of them, in the midst of some horrible personal crisis, and they're not going to be at their best. They are not good company, and they're never going to be good company. The people I was with were, by and large, white-collar crooks, petty crims, drug addicts, losers, you know, people who'd all done something dumb, like me. They weren't the worst of the worst. And I don't know whether this was an arrangement in relation to who I was or whether it's how the system works, but I was quarantined almost, I think, from the nasty guys in Singapore prison system, such that there are any. I did meet one guy who was an unrepentant rapist who had a girlfriend who wasn't behaving the way he thought she should, so he, you know, sorted her out. And he didn't understand the idea of rape very well, but was a gifted artist. And it's like a sociopath or something. And I came across him one day in a transfer arrangement. And he was probably the nastiest person I came across. So, you know, inmates are not getting any better by being in prison. And I think in the case of Schapelle Corby, really, you know, is this a master criminal? Or is this someone of poor judgment or someone related to people with poor judgment? I don't know. But I have enormous compassion for her and for people in that situation. And I think it is it's incumbent on me to say that, you know, prisoners are people too, and people shouldn't demonise prisoners just because they're prisoners. And you shouldn't remove from them their rights and entitlements to a justice system and to a just treatment and just humane treatment. And it's very easy for us in the media to say, prisoner, scumbag, and treat them with less civic dignity and respect than you would treat someone else. And to that extent, yeah, I've changed. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm sitting next to one, so I wouldn't say that. I think that's probably it's probably a little hard on them. Yeah, look, I'm not from the state, and I don't know what the debate's like, but I think it may be harsh of us to say that of them, because I'm not sure that they are as clinical in context as they may seem. Maybe a quote does, but quotes and context are two different things. Yeah.
Peter, Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. You've raised the issue of... so beloved of talkback radio hosts in some areas of stress and perhaps background and memories and dramas being contributing factors to poor decision making. You've also contrasted that with just going back some talkback radio hosts. It's a commentary in Australia that courts aren't hard enough on people who blame their family upbringing or what they've been through for criminal behaviour. You've contrasted that with the Singapore experience where you do the crime, you do the time, it's a mechanicistic situation and, you know, tough luck if you had a bad time in the lead-up to that. Can you, having been through the two, can you give us an idea if there is an appropriate intersection of those two systems so that the criminal, the victim, the society all feel it's a good system?
Yeah, I think Singapore is on the extreme end of lacking a desire to look at the nuance. Singaporeans get nuance, of course they do. They don't want to recognise it is the difference because it's a control society, and nuance challenges the essence of control. And I think it's a lot of cultural reasons why it is the way it is, which I talk about in the book. There's a thing called kiasuism in Hokkien and Chinese culture, which means never lose. And it's similar to losing face. So for them, the construct of their criminal system is about not losing. So the prosecution not losing in that sense, if you could think of it that way. So that's what underpins the fundamentals of that system. I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think our system is imperfect, perfect. We get it right some of the time, we get it wrong some of the time, and really isn't that just a reflection of society and us at large? And should we be surprised by that? And anyone who listens to Shock Jocks and takes them seriously is an idiot. I mean, they are not the people who should be making our decisions for us. They're there to improve their ratings and increase their salary, and you're going along for the ride. And anyone that thinks that the Shock Jocks, you know, handing out pearls of wisdom is making a huge error of judgment. Make your own informed decisions, but don't make them on the basis of what a Shock Jock tells you. That's not in the room.
Right. Peter, Catherine Dunne Armstrong, Australian Consolidated Press. My question is more personal. What you have achieved is, in actual fact, a strength of character, which is very much linked into Western philosophy. It's either come from an innate intelligence, it's come perhaps from an example in your background, in your family, or it's come from a maturity of years. What helped you develop that strength of character to overcome in prison what you did and remain with, you know, your integrity, your personal integrity, survive what most of us would sort of find appalling?
I have spent a long time in journalism seeing people and portraying people as victims. And I don't like victims, because that means they've surrendered to circumstance or surrendered. Now, that's not to say that all people who are victims can fight back against that or have any power over that, but my personal philosophy is that, and I think it's just from years of experience, too many people I've seen have given up, and I don't give up, ever. So I would not ever contemplate, until you stick a bullet in my head, giving up on anything that I want to do. If I put my mind to it, I don't stop. And I don't understand why people don't. And I didn't want to be portrayed or allow myself to fall into the psychology of victimhood. And I think it's a very dangerous psychology. It's a Western one, in a sense. I'll give you an example. In Thailand, after tsunami, the Thai people, they buried their dead, they grieved, and they got on with it. In a crude way, sort of suck it up, you know. They sucked it up, and they got on with it, because life is to be gotten on with. And along comes the anniversary, and I saw a whole lot of grief tourism of people related to the disaster who'd lost someone or who'd been involved with themselves who hadn't gotten past that moment and had allowed themselves or had found themselves in a state of suspended in animation emotionally where they were still victims of that moment. And the contrast, it really blew me away, the contrast between how the Thai people, and these are sweeping generalisations, but how the Thai people coped with crisis in comparison to the Farang, the Westerners. And it was pretty dismal on the Western side and pretty good on the Thai side. And there's a lot of reasons for that, cultural, religious, circumstantial. A lack of material welfare forces people to get back to work. You know, they had to get on with it. So there's a lot of nuance to that answer. But I think that the Western culture of victimhood is a significant factor, and it's a significant factor for me in driving me to not be one of those people.
Howdy, Tori Shepherd from The Punch. Is there any point where you wish you'd done something different earlier on? You seem to wish you'd done something different earlier on. I mean, most journalists, you know, in your career would think glamorous, jealous of being a foreign coro, all those different things. Is there an assignment you wish you'd turned down or a path you wish you hadn't taken?
When I was at university studying, my parents wanted to be... to study law, disgraced by the idea that I'd study journalism instead. And I was working at 2UE on weekends and be a little snot that I was, get ahead early. And my parents tried to have me sacked. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, happy days. But... you know, it's something I have thought about a lot because, you know, when we don't make, you know, generally speaking, we're not in this main game for the money, are we? I mean, it's not a wealth-creating job. None of it is easily planned either. I mean, I'm always astonished by people in journalism who talk about their life plan or their work plan. How the hell can you plan a career in journalism? You know, we're at the... behest of other people, by and large, and circumstances create opportunities as well as crises. So I think it's impossible to know. You know, I often wonder what would have happened had I stayed at the ABC when I was 21 years old and not gone overseas, because it was 10 years between leaving and then going back in. And going back in for the very cynical reason that I wanted to do work as a correspondent and it wasn't available elsewhere in a meaningful sense. So it's a good question, but I think about it a lot.
Heather from the Sunday Mail. Megan pointed out that you became the story. Does that give you any additional empathy when you're now, you know, in the job that you do now?
Depends who it is. Yes and no. I mean, I think that when you become the story, you become... it kind of slows down and you start to see the process of journalism being applied to you, the blowtorch getting applied to you. The most I understood in those early days was the media bit. I could see what was going to happen next and I knew how to respond or not respond. For example, you know when you walk outside of a lawyer's office and it's the first opportunity that they've seen you, you're going to get hammered. You know, you're just going to get hammered. And I did. Thanks, Jeff Parrish. Was that Jeff? Jeff from Channel 7. The attack guy from Channel 7. What's his name? Jeff Parry. He's a tiger. Yeah. I thought it was funny. I mean, I get the joke. I laughed because, you know, I knew what was coming. And it was more than when did you stop beating your wife. It was that on steroids. And people around me were mortified that it had happened. It was, how could he? So, of course he could. You see, the challenge is not the question being asked. The challenge is not to respond. You don't feed the beast. And I just kept my mouth shut and kept walking. And it was just white noise to me. But the people around me were a little bit caught up in the injustice of the moment. And it's one of those things that you have to, and I would advise people, and I have given it before and I'll give it in the future, as a media advisor, I think, is that you just got to let some stuff go. You just got to take the ride. And you need to know what's important and what's not. And, you know, doorstops and stuff like that, they're not important. The media in that sense at that moment is not important at all. There are other fish to fry at that point. But I think it's given me this, not an insight, but a view, and that is that I spend a lot less time worrying about stuff that's trivial as a journalist. I've kind of lost interest in the journalism of not the tabloid kind, but the sort of fast and easy stuff. I'm just bored of it. As a journalist, I'm only really kind of interested in public policy stuff these days. I mean, I want to talk about the big stuff because I think when you get a scare, a life scare, whether it's health or what happened to me, you realise there's only a certain amount of time. In the available space of your life, and I don't want to waste it anymore. And I have wasted some of it today, tonight.
Thank you. I'm Vivian Twelvetree. Peter, an interesting speech, thank you. As a journalist, obviously, you know that Singapore and drugs don't mix. Considering all you've been through, and obviously it's an enormous amount, who do you hope to help from all this?
I'm not the Messiah. I'm not trying to help anyone. But if people are interested in the story, I think that the ones I hope would learn the most from it are our bosses, the media bosses. Because what happened to me is, in a sense... a consequence of the structure of the media. There are too few of us at times doing too much. And all too often, in the context of the ABC, and increasingly so, and this is a view I put internally, so it's not going to be news if it's news, we're asked to do too much. And there is a management philosophy in all news media. And they've all drunk from the same Kool-Aid that less can be done, more can be done with less. And you know what? That's just not true. It is not true. And people who tell you it's true are drinking Kool-Aid. You can't send correspondents to places alone and expect them to feed a beast which is bigger by the day in the national broadcaster and not support them, not resource them, not replace them, cut their entitlements, cut their benefits, have staff who regard them as permanent tourists. It just doesn't work. And the message of my book is directed squarely at those kinds of managers. Have they learned from it? I don't think so. Has the post-traumatic stress message gotten through to the working journalist? Yeah, I think it has. I think we get it because we do the work. And I would hope that younger journalists coming into the game have a better appreciation of what it is that can happen to them in order to protect themselves. Because a lot of this, and this is back to my victim philosophy, a lot of this is also partly my own fault for not saying no. I never said no. And now I say no. And there's nothing wrong with saying no. And you're doing yourself a personal disservice as a journalist to say yes all the time. Because there's always someone that will go, goody, off you go. It's cheaper. We don't need to replace X because X will do it. So I think that the lesson is for the working journalist.
Well, g'day, Peter. David Eccles, ABC News. You were at the Bali bombings, and I was at the Taiza at the time, and I know people who went over there, and a couple in particular were profoundly affected by what they saw and experienced, and almost got too close to the story, and it affected their personal lives when they got back, to an extent. That, for many journos, was a one-off experience, maybe the biggest one of their professional career. That was one for you, one of your first ones as a correspondent. You went off to many more. We've all seen you doing all the big jobs, and you were out there for about 6 years. On your previous point, was it too long? Did you recognise that you were out there for too long yourself? Because and it took a crisis to change the policy. I think the ABC now has a policy of about 2-year rotation. Should that have been recognised earlier, perhaps? But the flip side of that is, if they enforce that sort of thing, saying you can only see a couple of big things and you have to come back and regroup and then maybe just stay on the domestic scene for a while, how does that inspire the journos who only want to be a foreign correspondent to know that they have to bust their balls for maybe 10 years and they might only be overseas for 2 years?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a conundrum.
I wouldn't want to be the one that imposes my my structure on someone else, because what worked for me or what would work for me wouldn't work for everyone else. And I think I'd be well pissed off if I was coming up and I thought that my ambitions to be a correspondent were being capped by the Peter Lloyd experience, because that's his business, not mine. So it's hard to make a one-size-fits-all rule or paradigm that works with that. And I think, again, it comes back, it's incumbent on the managers to manage people. You know, they're supposed to manage people, and that's the bit that some of them just don't get. You have to be involved. And that's not just about managing budgets, that's managing the personalities and correspondents by and large. Journalists are, but correspondents are even more so. They're big personalities and they'll push back and they require some personal management. And I think it's very much a management responsibility to look at the circumstances of everyone's posting. I don't think having an arbitrary two-rule cut-off is necessarily a wise idea, because I tell you what, it took me the first 12 months in Bangkok at the beginning of 2002 to get my head around it. I mean, that's ASEAN, which is what I covered, that's 10 different states, 10 different cultures largely, 10 different stories, 10 different histories. I had to sort of, you know, put myself through a 12-month, you know, tutorial in Southeast Asian politics, 2001. You know, it's like 100 years of history. And all I did for a year was I read everything on the area. So in the immersion process, that's a year gone. I wouldn't want to pull anyone out after 2 years, because you only get up to speed and you're only really peddling the good stories after a couple of years. And in fact, there's probably a strong argument for staying longer. I I think the issue isn't managing people in and out of the bureau, it's managing people in and out of the story. You've got to go below the bureau and look at the events. There might be horses for courses. It may be that people should be rested, you know, like a good thoroughbred, you know, for a month or two from the next big one. And the reason why I said before I was concerned about the lesson being learned is that look at Christchurch and look at the tsunami and the floods. In a sequence of several months, East Coast Australian journalists were involved with three catastrophic events, and in the ABC, there was, and this is public, so it's, I'm not talking at a school, John Taylor from Queensland was involved with the flood coverage and then was sent off to Christchurch, and we saw him publicly breaking down on 7:30 report. He shouldn't have gone, and it was poor management that you go, hey, John's doing well, and we'll keep pushing him. You push until they break. And I got in contact with management and said, you are not learning the lessons of what happened to me. To push him from that story to that story, and the basis was because the flights were available, is not good enough. It's as I say, it's about management, it's not about us, you know. I love the way it's always about the victim. It's the correspondent, you know, manage the correspondent. How about the managers do the managing? That's my argument.
Kate from the Sunday Mail. You talked about post-traumatic stress disorder before as something that crept up on you, and you've covered some pretty heavy stuff, but there must have been warning signs along the way. And do you have advice for journalists, even ones that aren't foreign correspondents, as to what to look for? And
yeah, take a holiday. I was very bad at taking holidays. I think in Singapore, as I was being structured out of the ABC, that I was given a list of how much annual leave I had accrued, and by July 2008, I think I had 70 or 80 days of untaken leave, which is a lot. So it's about taking responsibility for yourself as well, and even when you don't want to have a holiday, you don't feel the need for it, that's the time to take it. Not when you fall apart and you're getting sick, or you know, someone taps you on the shoulder and says, you know, you just drank three bottles of wine at lunch. You know, that's not the time to take a holiday. So it's self-managing is important, I think. Again, it's the synchronisation between the correspondent and the manager. There has to be there's got to be a third-party voice that says that's not good judgment. You know. I'm not always the best judge of the situation I'm in, and having someone else around is really important. And this goes to one of the other issues in this. The answer is that being in a posting where you're the only coro is good because you've got no one to fight with, but it's bad because you've got no one else to take the workload, to share the burdens of output, or to be... to hold up the mirror to you, you know, because in multiple correspondent bureau, there's enough interactions between the coros that you can see when someone else is, you know, getting a bit stressed out by their job. You know, Washington and London, Jerusalem, they're all Maltese. I worked in singles, Bangkok, Jakarta, Joburg, Moscow. These are all one-man operations, one-person operations, and they're all high-risk operations. In India, for example, and this is part of the answer again, is the remoteness is extraordinary. You are nowhere near planet Earth when you're in India. You're in planet India, and there is nothing about your life there that is normal, easy, or ordinary, no matter how much money someone gives you to go there. There's a detachment from head office, which is a risk factor. And I think, and this is another ABC issue, is that cutting back on entitlements and cutting back on the amount of time people get trips back home is a very, very poor piece of judgment, because it's not holidays, it's associations you're cutting. And when you start to disconnect from the mothership, when you're away from the mothership too long,
culturally, everything, you start to lose touch. And these are all those little X factors in what happens to correspondents when they stress out. This everything I say now is pre News 24, which is a beast in itself, right? It's even worse. I counted up when I was in Bangkok. I had 17 EPs, executive producers, that I answered to, in one form or another. 17 program makers. That's from the top of the list being the flagship, the 7 o'clock news, right down to the freaky deaky current affairs program no one watches or listens to, the correspondence report. They will all think that they have just had the best idea, the most original idea, and they also want to have it at the same time. It's like synchronized periods. Yes. they will expect you to do radio news off the top of the crisis pile. Is you've got to hit radio news. Then you've got to hit radio current affairs. Then 7 o'clock news. You've got to do late line. You've got to do the talking rounds of the drive programs in Melbourne, Brisbane, sometimes Adelaide, Perth always, don't know why, Sydney of course. You also have to make your travel arrangements. You've got to physically pack your bag. You've got to physically pack the technical equipment. There's 120 kilograms of that. What you pack is dependent on the story you're going for. You have to talk to the fixer where you're going, who arranges things. You have to organise your hotel. You need to know a little bit about the story as well. You need to find out what the hell happened. You've got to go on the phone. You've got to make calls. You have to... you've got to be a little bit like an air traffic controller at a busy airport on a stormy day. They keep coming in, like planes, like phone calls. And as soon as you hang up, it goes again. And there was a moment in Bali, at the Bali 9 trial, where for 45 minutes around the verdict, I would do a Q&A, and the moment I would hang up, the phone rang again without even ringing. That's how fast the calls are coming in. It's just a monster. And that was before News 24 even existed. Yes, Your Honour.
We do really actually have to get Peter to the airport, so I do need to wind it up. Thank you very much. If anyone lives up to that philosophy of what doesn't kill me makes me stronger, I think it's what we've heard today. So I'm glad that you like red wine and the journalism medication of choice. And so thank you very much from all of us here at the Press Club.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll be back with the raffle draw in just a sec. Okay, we're just going to do the raffle draw. So, you want to... got Dan Van Hoss Pelican to do it. So, I just want you to pick and then tell me, you can say what the ticket is. This will be for the $300 Jeff Timms Manufacturing Jewellers voucher. It's red F3. That's the main
don't
thing.
Need the name. Red.
Yes. It's a red Helen, F3. By the look.
Helen
Le Mesurer. Helen Le Mesurer. Aha.
There you go.
Fabulous. We keep going. Sorry, we've got more. I've got three more prizes. This is for the beer. The F3.
Red F71. Red F71.
Yep.
Okay.
This is some wine. Another red.
Another red one, F77. So probably up the back, somewhere close.
Oh. Okay. And one more. A colour besides red. Ah, no. It's for day, red day, isn't
it's
it?
It's the same winner.
Oh, is it?
Red F2, Helen.
Helen, it's your day. You've won some wine as well.
So,
thank you. Thank you very much. Before I actually finish all the formalities, I just would like to thank you all for coming today and supporting the Press Club lunch. I think that was an amazing story that we all got to hear. I'd just like to also promote our next two lunches. Wednesday, July 27, is Chief Justice John Doyle. And I think there'll be all sorts of things associated with, obviously, the justice system in the state, sentencing issues, you can imagine, that will be featured in that talk. And Monday, 15th of August, is the former Victorian Police Commissioner and the former head of the bushfire recovery program in Victoria, Christine Nixon, which again will be quite an interesting person, I think, to have. Ooh, a lot of oohs there, definitely. Thank you very much, and look forward to seeing you at another Press Club lunch.